Hello and welcome to episode 12 of A Life in the Landscape, a photography podcast with myself, Peter Cox, and my good friend, Roger Overall. Hello, Roger.
Ta-da, it's me, folks. Yes, hello, Peter. I had no wittier intro than that. I do. Wait a second. How do I get upgraded from good friend to great friend or very good friend?
I don't know. There's a whole process.
There's an application process.
In triplicate, yeah, you have to go through and there's stuff signed in blood and it's very messy.
Okay, I withdraw my application.
we'll see if we can arrange something on the sly.
Anyway, how are you? You're just back from an adventure.
I am. Yes, I was off on Cape Clear as we talked about last month. Yes, it was last month. So this was a trip where it was the first trip to be made for this upcoming book project, which is going to be on the islands of Ireland, off the West Coast specifically. And so Cape Clear is a place that's quite dear to me. We very nearly moved there 10 years ago. Well, no, but 9 years ago, just before Liam was born. And I had never actually photographed there, believe it or not, even though I'd been there many times. So it was really very rewarding to get out there and be able to go out and do some photography. So I was out there for, I suppose, 3 or 4 days during a period of really interesting weather. I think I sent you a text at one stage with a photograph and you were cursing me.
Well, I was, because we were WhatsApping. And just to set the context, where I was in Cork, which is not very far away from Cape Clear, it's probably a couple of hours drive. It was tipping.
Very, very wet drive, by the way.
Yeah, well, it was very wet. It was absolutely tipping with rain. We had Storm Deirdre coming through, just wreaking absolute havoc. And then I get a photograph on my WhatsApp from Peter that pings up, and there's clear skies. And this is only a couple of hours away. It's ridiculous. Yes. And I thought, well, surely there's a weather warning out for the entire south coast of Ireland, just not where Peter is.
Absolutely. So yeah, I was while I was there, we had some really nasty weather while I was there, but most of it happened at night. And this is the case with landscape photography, where you get the best conditions at the edge of weather. And I was fortunate enough to arrive just as a storm was coming. So I had some decent light the first morning that I was there, a really nice sunrise. And then, you know, the weather arrived and it was crappy during the day and crappy during the night, but then it went away. And there was this window between these two storm systems that also provided some really interesting light. So I expected to go out and maybe, you know, get one decent shoot, you know, go around the island and scout my locations and get soaked in the process and then get one decent image or one decent shoot out of it. But actually I got 4 or 5 images off the trip. In fact, I got all of the images that I want to get for the ground base portion of this island. So, you know, the idea of this book is that it will be sort of multidimensional. There'll be the ground-based tripod stuff, there'll be aerial stuff with the drone, and then there'll be stuff from the sea, from a boat. So I was able to pretty much knock out the land-based stuff on this one trip, which I did not expect to be able to do.
Specifically, what did you take photographs then of them? Because you know the island quite well. So talk us through, for instance, the photograph that you sent me. Well, you didn't send me the photograph you were taking. You sent me a photograph of your camera ready to take the shot. You had clear skies. We had so much rain. My next door neighbor was building an ark. Talk us through that particular shot and location. Because was there a ruin in the shot?
Yeah, so this is a castle. It's called Dún an Ór, which means the Fort of Gold. And it's on the western end.
What a name.
Isn't it great? So it's a 14th century O'Driscoll castle. And it was built in this headland. And it's a tower house. And funnily enough, I've known about it since my very first visit to Cape, which would be 9 or 10 years ago. And I haven't been back to Cape, actually, probably in 8 years. And I had intended to go and photograph this castle many, many times, because it's definitely the most iconic image from the island. It's hugely dramatic. It's sitting on a shattered headland. with dramatic rocks sticking up out of the water all around it. And then you're looking out to the west. And in fact, there's between the castle and the headland that's to its south, it makes this little V when you're at a particular vantage point, which is also the best point to photograph it. And you can see the Fastnet Lighthouse on the horizon through that notch. So it's something I'd really intended to photograph and just never got around to. So it was top of my list of things that I wanted to photograph on the island. And so that's where I took the image. I was out there. It was sort of during the afternoon. It was completely clear skies, unexpectedly clear. And, you know, looking at the satellite map, I could see that basically all of Ireland, except for like the very southwestern tip, was completely socked in with nasty, nasty weather, whereas everywhere else was nearly totally blue skies. In fact, very nearly too nice to photograph in.
Well, you sent me that satellite image, and it was as if somebody had drawn a ruler over Ireland, and on one side it was just this thick blanket of cloud, and then on the other side, nothing, just clear skies, it seemed. It was quite remarkable.
It really was. And so I, you know, came out of the little place that I was staying, and I had my electric bike that I brought with me, which very nearly didn't get allowed on the boat because the guy thought it was a motorcycle. we had to wait for the skipper to come to clear it for to be boarded.
So just talk about this bike very briefly then. I mean, this isn't just a regular pedal bike. If it's getting mistaken for a motorbike, this is either a very chunky push bike or there's something a bit more to it.
So it's an electric fat bike, which means that if you don't know what a fat bike
is... There's no need to get personal. Don't it's just the poor bike. Come on.
So if you don't know what a fat bike is, it's if you imagine a mountain bike and make the tires about twice as wide, it's, you know, it's really chunky, big tires, so it can go off-road and in almost any conditions, and then it's got an electric motor on it. So it's a push bike. It's got pedals and gears, but it also has an electric motor in the rear hub that can assist you. You need to go, you know, use it by itself, but, you know, if you're going up a hill, you definitely need to assist it. In fact, there are some hills on Cape that you couldn't even go up on it with even with the motor at maximum. It's still, and the gear at its lowest gearing, it's still far too steep. The problem with it is it's a fairly cheap bike by the standards of this thing, and it's incredibly heavy. I mean, it's bikes, you know, normally good bikes, you pick them up with your little finger. This thing, you know, I grunt when I lift it, and it's, you have to kind of brace yourself and lift it. It's nearly as heavy as a motorbike. So I guess because that's the thing that makes it cheap, is they made it of heavy metal. So anyway, it's this, you know, it caused a little bit of a stir on the boat and on the island. And of course, the other thing is, because it's so heavy, the downhills, because these hills that you can't really cycle up, you can certainly cycle down them, but actually some of them I wouldn't even risk it, because if you let the brakes go for a second, it's like driving an articulated lorry down a steep hill. It just wants to keep going and going. And I wasn't confident in my ability to stop.
I just have this mental image of you on having bought an electric bike to get you around this island. It comes with its limitations. Can't go uphill, can't go downhill.
Well, it can go uphill and downhill, but the thing is, Cape has some incredibly steep hills. It's like the San Francisco of the Irish Islands. These really steep hills. You could make some great car chases on that. And actually, the nice thing is, if you do have to push it up the hill, at least you can get the motor going, so you don't have to be pushing it up. It's just driving up, and you're holding on to the thing guiding it. So it actually works fairly well, and I was pretty happy with it in general. But I forget now why I brought it up.
It was to help you get around the island. You had an adventure just getting it onto the island. Just out of interest, once the captain had seen it and passed it as not being a motorbike, what about on the island itself as you're riding around there? Did anybody sort of feel compelled to stop you and tell you you couldn't ride the thing around the island?
No, it was. And the reason that they don't want, so because it's just a push bike and it doesn't go super fast. And I think the reason they have against allowing motorbikes on the island, it's not so much not allowing them on the boat, it's that they don't want people, you know, joyriding around the island on motorbikes, which is reasonable. So there was no issue with that. I did have, at one point, as I was coming up a hill on the way back home in the evening, the front light on the bike was going off and there was a car in front of me, and he actually stopped at the top of the hill because the way the headlight was wiggling, he thought somebody was running up the hill behind him with a torch trying to get him to stop. Yeah.
And was the bike able to get you to everywhere you needed to go? Can it go off-road, or did you not need to go off-road, in fact?
It can go off-road, but it's, sometimes it was just easier to walk it. But I did use it to get around a fair bit off the roads, and it worked very well as long as the hill wasn't too steep. It was quite successful. It'll be getting a bit of a trial by fire maybe when I take it out of the basket, because that's also very steep, but there's just tracks. But I mean, certainly from my experience on Cape, it's well able for it. So yes, that's the story of the bike.
But it allowed you presumably to be quite flexible in your photography and also to turn up on location, not completely knackered.
Exactly. That's the reason why I have the electric one, so that you can, because I knew there'd be places where you'd be trying to get to, where I would have to walk or hike, and you don't want to be carrying, having to basically expend a lot of energy and then be exhausted when you get to the spot and having a difficulty making the photograph just because you don't want to be there because you're tired. So it did that admirably, and I was able to get everywhere I wanted. The one thing is, I won't be able to, like when I go out there with the heavy drone, that's not practical to put on a bike, so I'll have to beg or borrow a car for that one. And that one can only really be launched near a car because it's just too bulky to carry any distance.
So you're on the island. The weather's pretty rotten for the first couple of days, or the first day at least. But you knew it was going to clear up, or were you kind of in a mindset of, look, the weather's going to be the weather, I'll get some pretty dramatic photographs regardless?
Yeah, so that was the idea. I knew the weather was going to be a bit shaky, and when you're photographing coastal stuff, you want a little bit of shaky weather, but you would like it to be a bit broken. So yeah, I recall now where I came from the bike thing, because we were talking about the Dúnan Óir and the fact that it was so clear. So I left the place on the bike, cycled down to Dúnan Óir, or as close as you can get to it reasonably, which involves actually crossing a field boundary that has an electric fence, which is incredibly powerful. Thankfully, the fencer wire was strung quite low, so you could be reasonably sure when you put your leg over it that you're not going to get zapped in a very sensitive area, but it's still very too close for comfort. And I was wearing, sort of thin hiking pants, and at one stage I got over the bit on the landward side of this field, which is right again, there's the field and then there's the cliff. So I'm on the landward side of the field, I cross in there, it's quite low, and then I get around to a point where there's a gap in the wall on the other side of the electric fence leading out toward the cliff. But the wire is a little bit higher there, and I'm just not all that certain that if I commit to swinging over that I'm not going to get zapped. Like, I'm practically, taking a ruler and sort of measuring the distance between the wire and my crotch,
And you need to be, this is not a sort of bail out halfway through kind of maneuver, really, is it? You want to know beforehand.
Yeah, exactly. And so what you'd normally do is you'd find the fence post, right? And you'd sort of put a hand on the fence post to steady yourself as you're swinging your leg over. So at least you can kind of back out halfway if you think that you're not going to make it. But the problem with this fencer wire is it's so powerful that it's connected to these wooden fence posts, and it was connected through an insulating, like there was a little loop that had some insulation on it that the wire went through. But as I put my hand on the wood post to support myself, I felt the shock, like, because it pulses, right? It's not continuous. So it every second or so it pulses. And I would put my hand down, and it wasn't terribly sore, but I could definitely feel, it was uncomfortable enough that I wouldn't leave my hand there. So I couldn't even use that for support. So I kind of stood there for a while and said, well, I won't I? And eventually did. And then after, actually, the first time I did it and I got my photographs and I'd explored a little bit, I found a bit of the field where this wire was not, hadn't been finished. So in fact, I was able to get back much more easily. So anyway, I get there and I get to the spot and I'm setting up and I'm looking. And what's great about this time of year is that the sun is going to be setting pretty much right behind the Fastnet Lighthouse from where I'm standing. And I'm thinking, this could be absolutely amazing. I mean, I'm here at this time, which I didn't plan for, and incredibly fortunate. And now I've got this beautiful blue sky day, which I ordinarily wouldn't like, but if I can get this Fastnet with the sun right behind it and it's silhouetted with the setting sun, how amazing would that be? So I'm sitting there, it's about an hour and a half to sunset. I figured I'd just get there early in case clouds moved in, and I'm idly scouting and sort of making time and just relaxing, waiting for things to happen. And I've got the camera set up, And then, of course, the clouds start to roll in on the horizon. So it's still clear directly above me, but the clouds roll in at the horizon, and they roll right in such that they, as they always do, they block the lighthouse, or sorry, block the sun as it gets down to the horizon. It was still a nice sunset, and I still actually, probably one of my favorite photographs of the castle that I took was on that evening, just as the sun was getting obscured by the clouds. It's just above the lighthouse and looks quite nice, but it wasn't what I was hoping for.
No, this is the curse of being able to visualize a photograph ahead of time, because it clearly was going to be the grandest and the greatest photograph ever taken of the Fastnet Lighthouse. And then along comes Mother Nature waving two fingers in your face, and there you go. Note for you, not the picture you wanted. You'll have something else instead.
But again, a picture that that works well. So, you know, it's very important to be able to, and I've learned this lesson in the past, to be able to let go of your preconceptions and work with what you're given, which wasn't difficult in this case, because it was very nice. It just wasn't, you know, sometimes it can be a little less obvious, the results you get, even though it's still quite good. But in this instance, it was quite good.
And what about other locations on the island? This castle sounds fairly well-known, fairly popular, fairly obvious. Were there other locations that were less obvious or, in fact, completely new to you?
There were. So there is the remains of a lighthouse on the island at one of its highest points, which is on the cliff on the southward side, which was, in fact, the lighthouse that used to be in that location before the Fastnet was built. And the Fastnet was built because this light is too high up above sea level. So in fog, it would be obscured and ships didn't see it, and then they would hit rocks and sink. So they decided they needed to build a lighthouse somewhere further out. Actually, that would hit the Fastnet and sink. So they decided maybe we better build a light on there.
So it's like the trial and error approach to putting up lighthouses.
Well, I suppose I can see their point. You know, it's at this time, you know, meteorology would have been in its infancy, and the idea of a lighthouse being too high up. You know, you think a light needs to be high so it can be seen from a distance, and nobody really realized that actually the problem is fog, which happens quite a lot. So it certainly was trial and error, but perhaps excusably so.
That was something you knew about because of your love of lighthouses, but it never really been to, never really photographed yet.
So I went up there. I was aware of it, and I'd seen it, but hadn't gone up to it on my previous trips. I went up there thinking it might make a good photograph, and it's actually, there's the tower of the lighthouse, the stone tower, the actual lantern is gone, so it's just this kind of a headless lighthouse. And then there's also a Napoleonic watchtower right next to it, and then there's kind of in this walled compound. And there wasn't really a photograph. I mean, I'm sure there's a photograph to be made, but there wasn't one that sort of sang out to me when I went up there. It would be, I think, quite good from the air, so I think I'll photograph it that way. But from the land, you know, it didn't have any context. It would just be a photograph of this structure rather than this structure in the landscape, because it's so high relative to the surrounding island. So photographing it from the air, I'll be able to give it that context. So what I ended up doing was I photographed it from, so there's a road that goes up to it, and the last maybe 200-300 meters of that road is a grass track, and it's quite picturesque, and it sort of has this lovely curve to it, and there's these nice stone walls going along there, and you're looking back down toward the west end of the island, and you can actually see again the Fastnet on its rock out in the distance. So I photographed that with this curving grassy road leading up toward the Fastnet lighthouse. So it's actually from one lighthouse to another, but we don't have the photograph. We don't have the, even though I'm standing right next to the old lighthouse, you don't see it in the image.
Okay. So generally speaking, from what you're saying, very successful trip.
Yes, I was very happy with it.
So you're going back to do drone photography, and you're also going back, if I understand it correctly, to photograph from the water. Now, are you doing this in all three locations? Oh, sorry, not in all three locations, in all of the locations for the new project, so that each location or island group actually gets photographed three times?
I think that's fair to say. That's the plan anyway.
Gosh, that is a big project. Now, presumably, you wouldn't be able to go back in the kind of weather we've been having and do your drone work, or maybe not even be able to go back in the kind of weather we've been having to do your boat-based work. So is that going to be compressed into sort of the summer months? How are you going to work on that logistically?
I would expect so. I mean, I'll go back and do the drone stuff maybe in the spring, because, you know, the drone can operate in conditions that you'd be surprised by. And you know, I thought about bringing it on this trip, but I work better if I do. If I'm photographing from a tripod, it's better that I don't have a drone, because then I'm distracted by the possibilities there and I'm not thinking as clearly. And likewise, if I've got the drone, I can't think about I'm distracted if I'm thinking about tripod based stuff. So I decided just to make each trip separate based on the medium I'm using. So yeah, it's spring and summer for the boat and aerial work. And then if there's any other work that needs to be done next winter for ground based stuff, then I'll do it then.
And that's an interesting point, because it's almost, because you're limiting yourself, you're concentrating on one particular way of taking photographs, but it can also stimulate creativity, because, you know, they do say, if you want to improve your photography, limit yourself to one camera and one lens, and then you know, those are the fixed things. So the thing that's going to change the photograph, the things that are going to make the photographs different, is your creativity, is your interpretation and what you do with the gear you've been given. So if you limit the gear, it's not like you can have these big debates about, well, shall I have 12 millimeters, 14 millimeters, 18 millimeters or 24 millimeters? No, you have no choice. You only have one lens.
That's true. And actually, as it happened on this trip, because I was using this new Phase 1 camera that I acquired, and I have one lens for it at the moment. So I was in fact using one camera with one lens.
It's a very minimalist Zen approach to photography.
Yes. And it's quite comfortable, because, I mean, it really does, because you find if you have more than one lens, and there are definitely times when, you know, you need a long lens or you need an ultra wide lens. But there are always opportunities for the lens that you have if you just have one, and it makes you work just a little bit harder to find them. And, you know, you can't be quite so lazy and say, I'll just shoot this with the obvious lens. You work with maybe something that's a little bit less obvious, and it also removes distraction, because you're not tempted by the other viewpoints. You're not tempted by saying, oh, you know, I wonder how this would look with a wide lens, and then by the time you've done futzing around, the light is gone.
Yes. The landscape photographer's nightmare, I would imagine, is the light changing as you're trying to get your gear sorted.
Oh yeah, I've done that more than once.
Look, you're pretty much just back from this trip, so no real post production has taken place. But any of the images you've got, you've been able now to say they're good enough. They meet the Peter Cox test. Say, right, they can appear in the book. They can appear in the gallery. Any among them that you took that you classify as a favorite of the year?
It's hard to tell, because you always like the most recent photographs you've made, you know, so you need to live with them a little before you make that kind of a judgment. But I think, because I've wanted to photograph this castle for so long and hadn't done it, that, you know, I have probably, let's see, one, two, three, four photographs that are candidates to go in the book, and maybe even more than one will appear in the book. And there's one in particular that I think is certainly my favorite of the trip, and that would make it a favorite of the year, if not the favorite, but certainly a favorite.
Well, let's actually, because you make a very good point about your last photo shoot is kind of the one that is in the glow of warmth and, you know, glory and what have you. Let's disqualify it. Let's say, right, we can't have that one. So that image has now been disqualified and discarded as the favorite of the year, because it's too fresh in your memory and it's too close to you. Of the images you've lived with for the year, let's just talk about those then. Have you got some favorites or a favorite that you've taken this year? Let's just talk about 2018's highlights.
Sure. So I suppose the thing about 2018 is I haven't done a huge amount of photography this year. When I look at my folder for the year, it doesn't have as many entries as others have, but it's incredibly diverse. So, you know, my first shoot of the year was in Dubai, which I was there for a couple of days, and I took a photograph of the city at sunrise with the fog, the low-lying fog that it's famous for, where, you know, some of the buildings are sort of obscured at their bases and you just have the tops of them sticking out. And so that photograph that I have from there is one that it's very atypical for me, because it's not really a landscape scene, it's a cityscape. And it's in a type, and it's in an environment that I don't normally experience, which is very hot and dry instead of cold and wet. So I think I do like it. It's an image that I enjoy very much. So that would certainly be a candidate.
What is it about it that you like in particular? Is it the alienation of just these hovering buildings, seemingly just floating on air? Is it that it's almost an alien environment for you? Is it the light? Is it the composition?
I suppose it's a bit of all those things, really. It's a very soft orange light. And then you've got these hard metallic structures, you know, with this sort of cotton wool of fog surrounding them and obscuring them. And I like the composition. It was also a very enjoyable shoot. You know, I was up there on the sort of top deck of this hotel, looking out over this landscape, and you know, met you know, a couple of interesting people and had an enjoyable morning's photography. So as well as the photograph itself standing alone, there's also the experience of having photographed it.
And if you'd like to see this photograph, by the way, listener, you can go to Peter's website, petercox.ie, and if you go to the United Emirates Gallery, there is the photograph that we are talking about with the city. It actually almost looks as if the photograph was taken with a drone. And the reason I say that is because Dubai is not like New York, where all the skyscrapers are all bunched up very close together. In Dubai, the skyscrapers seem sort of spread out, so they breathe a bit more. So you almost don't get a sense that this was taken from another skyscraper. It almost feels like you're a bird flying through the city. Has a very peaceful quality that way, sort of that you're almost suspended above the city, free from any structures.
Yes, it does have that sort of a feel to it. And it's from a commercial standpoint, it's, you know, there is an awful lot of Irish people that live in Dubai. So, you know, a Dubai photograph made by an Irish photographer might be something that could be interesting for expats or their families. And then, you know, in February, I was commissioned to do some time-lapse work. And this was during the big storm, the snowstorm that we had. You know, where the government said, you know, everybody needs to be inside by a certain time or else... you're being very irresponsible and you're causing risk to others that would need to come and rescue you.
People in Finland thinking to themselves, what's the big problem?
and to be honest, that's true. But of course, we don't have the infrastructure to deal with it here.
We're not used to it. We just don't have, you know, Finnish levels of snow preparedness and snow experience.
And we have snow experience of snow.
And also, I'd like to see them deal with the levels of rain that we get. Ha, there.
Absolutely. that project was to photograph time lapses of castles in the snow, so that was quite interesting. There were no stills that came out of that one, but it was wonderful to do because I got to drive my new 4x4 and put it through its paces, which really worked very well, and so it was enjoyable to go around and do it. And also, I enjoy time lapse photography. I haven't done it in a long time, but you know, I do the whole motion control thing where the camera is connected to a computer and it's on a motorized rail and a motorized head so that it can be programmed to move in a certain way throughout the time lapse. So it was very enjoyable to be able to go back and do that.
And also these castles being photographed this way, looking with a dusting of snow, well, I said dusting of snow, it wasn't really a dusting of snow, it was proper snow. That is something very rare. So it's not something that can be easily replicated or is a common photograph or a common piece of footage of these buildings.
That's very true. And actually, the crowd that I did the work for, they got more than they bargained for in terms of, they actually hired two photographers. They hired me in the south and they hired a guy from the Northern Ireland. And they had us go and photograph castles, and they had some kind of specific castle they wanted done. And as it turned out, they told both of us the same list and didn't tell us that we were both doing stuff and didn't put us in touch with each other. So we ended up duplicating effort. So, you know, I went to a castle and then, you know, another castle. And then I was talking to the guy after it was all done. And he said, oh yeah, I did that one.
I'm surprised. Oh my God, that would have been very embarrassing if you both turned up at the same time, not knowing really about each other, and both there for the same client. That could have been an interesting standoff.
Absolutely. So yeah, it was a bit silly that they, you know, they didn't think to do that. They would have gotten a broader spectrum, but I suppose they actually ended up getting, you know, two viewpoints of the same stuff. It'd be interesting. I haven't actually seen the finished project yet, so it'd be interesting to see whose they used.
It's well, what's interesting is you'd love to see, because as you say, you've got two different interpretations of the locations.
Yes.
And that, and also presumably when he was out, would the other photographer have been out same time of year? So amidst those snowstorms
as
well?
It was over the same period. We were specifically hired to go out and do it during the snow because that's what they wanted. That's when they would get the conditions.
Which is even more remarkable that you didn't bump into each other.
Yes.
Anyway, and now you know, you turned up and you're thinking to yourself, who the bloody hell's been walking around this castle ruining this pristine snow with their big clomping boots?
Exactly.
This is the third castle in a row this has happened to.
And there's tripod holes everywhere too. Right?
Yeah.
Oh dear. Yeah.
So that was, you know, another kind of style of photography, completely different. So that was a highlight. Anything else that springs to mind that looking back over the year?
Yeah, so you know, every year or every other year, I do some work in the Aran Islands with my sister, who's a geologist, and I think we've probably mentioned this on the podcast before. It's photogrammetry where you're going out and essentially making a 3D model of a thing or a location. And we do this for these boulder ridges along the west coast of the Aran Islands, which are formed by storm waves and these massive boulders. And we definitely talked about this before.
We did, yes. Where the power of the ocean just lifts these massive boulders quite basically up onto cliff edges. Which is astonishing.
The boulders start on the cliff edges, but they get quarried from there, and then they get moved about, even though they're 40 meters above high water, and quite far inland as you get lower down. So that work was done around in June, and I also did some creative work there, which I don't normally on those trips, but it was a long enough trip, and we had good enough weather that there was some time for me to go off and do some creative photography, which I will, in fact, so I've probably already done the aerial work for the Aran Islands, in fact, for because they will appear in the book as well.
And just to your work with your sister and your sister's research has actually proved that the waves have been moving these rocks around. Is that right?
That's true, yes. So she had proved this before I started working with her on the with the drone, but by basically, you know, sort of dating the rocks that had come out of the ocean. She could date them very accurately to being younger than the last known tsunami to have hit this area. And it's not something that you miss, a tsunami, you know, you know when the last one is. They don't sneak in and you go, was that a tsunami? So yeah, so what we've done with the drone is we have, by flying over the coastline and mapping and modeling the ridges along the whole length of the coastline, or at least where there are ridges, we have been able to look at them year on year and from one winter to the next and compare them and say, okay, well, this amount of material was moved. And in fact, there is some quite clever software that one of our students has put into use where you take it's called cloud compare. So you basically take the point cloud that is made as a result of the model that you're producing, and you compare it in software to the same one from a different time, and it will show you colored in areas. It will say, okay, well, material was removed from here and it was added there. Mm-hmm. So you can sort of computationally show what's been going on, as well as just saying, well, that particular rock there I recognize is not there anymore and it's now over here.
Very clever stuff. So that's scientific work as well that you've done this year.
Yes.
Anything else that sticks out? I've got an image in mind.
In terms of the variety, you know, to briefly touch on, you know, there was a Bull Rock image, I did, which we can talk about. And then there was I was out in Svalbard in the Arctic, and then also out photographing the Fastnet Lighthouse for RTE for for the Lighthouse documentary that they did, which also featured, in fact, the Bull Rock image.
So just a tremendous variety. So you're not just a landscape photographer who goes out and does sunsets and sunrises. Not that you do that anyway, but there's tremendous variety to the work you do. I mean, you do drone work, you do time-lapse work. Not only is it time-lapse, not static time-lapse. You know, you've got the time-lapse where the camera is moving over various axes. You do video work. You've done the scientific work with your sister. It's like there's so many strings to your bow. It's almost too many. The bow is almost too big. The Bull Rock woman, because that's a lovely image. And again, people can go to the website, petercox.ie, and they can see the photograph, and it's an interesting one because you spoke briefly on the early on the podcast about how you were on Cape Clear. You had this idea in your head. You saw an image in your mind's eye of the sun setting behind the Fastnet Lighthouse in the distance, and my God, it was going to be amazing. And then that didn't happen because cloud cover rolled in. Therefore, the horizon became behind the Fastnet became obscured by clouds, so therefore the sun would vanish behind the cloud before it could illuminate the Fastnet from behind. But with the Bull Rock, that didn't happen. You actually got quite a remarkable image. Talk about, first of all, I suppose, the particular structure of the Bull Rock and what you were trying to achieve, and not trying to achieve, what you actually achieved in the photograph.
Yeah, so the Bull Rock is a rock that's 120 or 130 feet tall out in the Atlantic off the end of the Barra Peninsula, which is the peninsula south of the Ring of Kerry for those that are a little bit familiar but not very familiar. And it has a lighthouse on it, which I've actually stayed in 2009, although it's now been more or less decommissioned. There is a light still there, but the old lighthouse tower is no longer used. There's a light on the very peak of the rock. That blinks, but it has a very interesting natural feature, which is a tunnel that goes all the way through the rock that you can in fact drive a boat through. And there's a video that I shot the same day that I photographed this image that we're going to talk about, where you see just that happening. We drove the boat through the tunnel, and I followed it with the drone. And I know we've mentioned this before on the podcast. So this fantastic tunnel, which is oriented northeast to southwest, and right around the summer solstice, there's a few days in the year when, as the sun is rising, you can look through the tunnel from the seaward side, looking back toward the land, and you can see the sun rising through the rock. And there's also a corresponding day around the winter solstice, where the reverse happens, where you can see the sun setting if you're looking through the rock out to sea. And it's something that I had an idea that it might be a nice thing to photograph. In fact, it was suggested to me by the boat operator that I used to go out. And he actually rang me and gave me the heads up that this was happening and we should maybe go out and give it a go. And this was during the period of incredibly warm and stable weather that we had during the summer. And we were in fact able to make a date and say, okay, well, you know, the Thursday doesn't really suit me, but we could go out on the Friday instead.
When do you ever get to do that in Ireland? Usually it's we need to go now.
Yeah, and there's a 1 in 10 chance we'll go. It's a great chance, let's go get it. Whereas this one was like, well, we can get it pretty much any time this week we want to, so let's just pick a day that suits us best, which never ever happens. And by rights, actually, it shouldn't have happened. It should have punished us for being so presumptuous. But no, we went out. You know, I overnighted near there the night before, and then before sunrise, we went out and photographed this thing. So we're out on the Atlantic side, and we're looking back at the rock, which is silhouetted, and you can make out, you know, sort of it's a gannet tree. So there's all these hundreds or possibly a couple of thousand gannets on the rock. So you can see their leavings, which make for a nice little detail on the seaward face of the rock. And you can see the lighthouse and the helipad and the sun coming up, the actual, you know, disc of the sun through the rock.
It's quite remarkable. And as you say, the nothing is blocking the sun. It's just coming through. And it's a glorious picture. Not a cloud in the sky by the looks of it. And just that lovely blue at the top of the frame. And as you go down, it goes into that yellow and then the orange of the horizon where the sun is coming through. And lots of birds in the sky. And you can see this picture I may have said this before, but you can see this picture on the website, petercox.ie. You can even buy a print there.
Absolutely. You can indeed. And yes, we have a very large print of it actually hanging in the gallery. So if you're in Killarney, do stop in and go upstairs to the upstairs gallery and you'll see it nice and large there.
This is the kind of print that you could print extraordinary large on your printer, I would imagine. But that it's a spectacular photograph. Okay, look, we've been going on for quite a while.
We have.
And before we start losing listeners basically of old age, we should wrap up the episode. Where can people follow you in 2019? Where can they find out what you're up to?
Well, as always, on petercox.ie on the website. You can stop into the gallery in Killarney, and you can also follow me on Instagram as at petercoxphotography, and Facebook and Twitter too. So Peter Cox Photo on Facebook and Twitter, Peter Cox Photography on Instagram. So yes, and we hope you had a fantastic Christmas and that you have a very happy and prosperous 2019.